KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Seven on short domestic flights. Then it will start the long-haul international flights the jet was made for. The grounding stalled delivery in Everett for 4 months on a plane that had already been plagued for years with delays. Here's a novel idea, walking to school. Students at Centennial and Little Mountain Elementaries in Mount Vernon are walking or riding bikes to test what happens when the district eliminates school bus stops within 1 mile of school. A pilot project to test school safety zones kicked off today. The Skagit Valley Herald reports the state will no longer pay for busing within a mile of school unless it is unsafe to walk. Police are asking drivers to be extra vigilant and pay attention to crossing guards. Scientists around the world will soon have access to a wealth of data from a lab at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. The National Science Foundation is paying the University of Washington to put a laboratory as deep as 2 miles below the waves and partly on top of an underwater volcano. They will be turning on 40 sensors of 13 different types as they are installed this summer, with the lab to be fully operational by early 2015. I'm Lisa Brooks, KUOW News.
And support comes from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. 10:06, KUOW 94.9 News and Information. I'm Jack Walters. Good morning. 54 degrees. Expecting a high today pushing 70, mostly sunny. Tonight's low around 48 degrees, mostly cloudy skies tonight. Rain likely after 11. Tuesday, cooler weather, a high in the mid-50s with showers. Tuesday night, a low around 46, clouds, showers likely. And on Wednesday, a high in the mid to upper 50s, cloudy, showers likely in the Seattle area. It's 10:30. It's 10:06, rather.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. William Saturno says he always wanted to be an archaeologist. We're going to talk to him about his work on the ancient Maya coming up. Also going to hear about medical interventions and the end of life. Boeing 787 has returned to the skies after a four-month grounding by the FAA. A United Airlines Dreamliner took off this morning from Houston en route to Chicago's O'Hare Airport. Joining us now is Richard Abulafia, an aerospace analyst with Teal Group Corporation. And thank you for being with us, first of all. This is the first U.S. airline, but not the first flight of the 787 since the worldwide grounding, right?
Yes, that's correct.
How many other airlines have put these planes up in the air?
Oh, very few. I believe the Japanese carriers have started. I think India, but this is among the first.
United says it's going to do just short haul flights for now. Has anybody done any long flight with this battery fix?
Not to the best of my knowledge, except on test flights, perhaps.
Boeing says it's confident of its fix. The FAA gave its approval. What about consumers?
You know, I think memories are pretty short. As long as the 787 can be as safe as all other jetliners, and there's no reason it can't, people will forget pretty quick. I mean, at the end of the day, you had the A380 disaster, which looked far worse, the engine blowing up in midair, and then the plane being landed by a fairly Herculean effort by the pilots back in Singapore back a couple of years ago. And within a matter of weeks, it had all been forgotten. And then you think back to the last time a U.S. jetliner was grounded, had its certification yanked, which was the DC-10 back in the late 70s. It was far worse, hundreds of people dead, and they never really found a fix for it. And it wasn't all that great a plane to start with. And within a couple of weeks, again, people had returned to flying it. So given the fact that nobody's been hurt by this series of events, I don't think they'll have a problem.
The FAA gave its approval to Boeing's fix, but the National Transportation Safety Board is still looking into what happened. Am I right about that?
That's correct, but the FAA takes precedence in this decision.
And why is the NTSB still probing if the FAA has given the permission already?
That's kind of unclear. It's a bit of a wild card in all of this, the hearings they've been holding. It might be due to politics. It might be due to a legitimate concern about FAA processes. But it's important to remember they have different mandates at the end of the day. The NTSB is purely concerned about safety, and the FAA balances a wide array of concerns.
I know that Boeing is putting in the battery fix, I assume, airplane by airplane. How long does it take to retrofit, do you know?
Not all that long. I think it should all be done in the next few weeks.
And so we expect to see the fleet of 787s up in the air?
That's correct. As a matter of fact, they've already begun deliveries of new aircraft on top of that, with the fix already inserted, of course.
And there's no anticipation that this fix isn't going to work. So how long do you suppose they give the short-haul flights before they start saying, well, let's see if it can do something transatlantic?
I don't think it'll be all that long. And then ETOPS approval, the approval to go long distances away from land, in extended-range twin-engine operations, that should be forthcoming pretty quickly, too. You know, it looks what they've done, it looks like, from a safety standpoint, I think it does the job just fine. I think it might become an issue of economics, though. If there really are additional battery cell concerns, then you might have the risk of lower degrees of aircraft readiness. You might have unwanted warning lights. And then, of course, in order to fix these things, you have to break open this containment vessel and reinsert cells, and that might be time-consuming. So even though from a safety standpoint they've got it right and it looks very promising, you could see hiccups from the standpoint of aircraft readiness moving forward.
Interesting. In the meantime, Boeing has bet most of its future on this 787. I understand not long from now, Airbus is set to unveil its competitor for the sort of hyper-carbon fast and light airplane.
To a certain extent, the A350 is meant to basically go between the 787 and the 777, but lately sales have definitely migrated upwards, which means it's more of a 777 competitor. But here's where it gets complicated, because of doubts about Boeing's ability to execute on another program right after the 787 incident. Airbus has been capitalizing on that and doing really well, and thus the big talk has emerged in the background of Boeing's ability to get the 777X, a major derivative of the 777, up and running. So it's kind of like the problems associated with the Dreamliner are actually haunting a new generation of Boeing planes that are needed to respond to the A350.
No, it's interesting. You mentioned consumers forget pretty quickly, but I would assume that airlines maybe are more leery when they're about to invest millions and millions of dollars into a vehicle for shuttling passengers.
No, that's exactly right. They made it clear they can't afford another 4 or 5 year delay, especially when you might have a competitor in the airline biz who takes a plane 4 years earlier from the other guy and has a huge advantage over you. You know, you've got this traumatic incident. At the first time that a Boeing plane's been delayed more than, say, 4 to 6 months, that's really coloring everybody's impression. So Boeing needs to send a signal that it's all about engineering excellence and performance, because right now they're struggling under this this overhang of a very unpleasant experience from an airline customer perspective.
So there's a lot of worries, I assume, in Chicago at the Boeing headquarters.
I expect there's worries everywhere at Boeing right now. How quickly they can get confidence back. As a matter of fact, you've got this very long alliance, very successful alliance between Boeing and Japan, both in the industrial level and the airline level. A couple weeks ago, news broke that Airbus was negotiating for an A350 sale to Japan and Japan Airlines and All Nippon. That would be an unprecedented and very dangerous development for Boeing, so they've got to get on top of this.
Richard Abulafia is an aerospace analyst with Teal Group Corporation. Thanks for joining us this morning. And as we mentioned, the first Boeing 787 United Airlines Dreamliner took off this morning from Houston en route to Chicago's O'Hare Airport. This is Weekday.
It's 10:14.
Join KUOW for the 2013 Seattle International Film Festival, now through June 9th. In its 39th year, SIFF is the largest film festival in the United States, showcasing 447 films from 85 countries this year. Learn more on the events page at KUOW.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the Whatcom Museum's Lightcatcher Galleries in Bellingham, featuring Jim Olson, Art in Architecture, a retrospective of the Seattle architect whose work includes the design of the Lightcatcher Galleries. Open through June 9th. Details about the exhibition at whatcommuseum.org.
54 in Seattle, expecting a high today around 70, mostly sunny skies. Tonight, the low dropping down to 48, mostly cloudy, rain likely after 11 o'clock tonight in the Seattle area.
From 94.9 KUOW, I'm Marcy Silman. Williams Turner says he always wanted to be an archaeologist. He conducted excavations in his backyard when he was a little kid, but it wasn't until college that Saturno found out you could actually make a career out of archaeology. And about that same time, William Saturno discovered the ancient Maya. It was love at first sight. Most recently, Saturno has found proof that the urban myth about the Mayan calendar pointing to the end of the world in 2012 is just that, a myth. William Saturno joins us today. It's a pleasure to have you here.
It's great to be here.
All right. Seriously, you wanted to be an archaeologist when you were a little kid?
Yeah, that's, I mean, the first legitimate thing that I wanted to be, and certainly legitimate is used loosely there. I mean, the first thing that you could actually be, I mean, I wanted to be a dinosaur.
Okay.
I wanted to be a prehistoric mammal, but career options were limited.
So when you were little, when digging in the backyard, like 5, 8, 10, how old?
Yeah, 5. I mean, I can certainly remember in kindergarten saying to my kindergarten teacher that I wanted to be an archaeologist when I grew up, and her response being less than favorable. And
really?
Saying, yeah, why don't you be a policeman?
Really? Wow. Yeah. What were you digging for, bones?
Anything, really. I mean, I wasn't very good at it, I'll confess this. I mean, I would bury things. I would bury my own toys. I would bury things of my parents, and then I would try and find them. Of course, like I said, I wasn't very good at it. I pretty much didn't find anything that I hadn't ever put there. You know, the idea of finding maybe an arrowhead. I mean, it was upstate New York. Maybe some animal bone, something that I might find. I never found.
This is my disclaimer. I used to dig in the sandbox in my backyard and found something that I was sure was an Indian tooth, and I sent it off to a museum. And you can guess the answer.
And was that a no?
Slag.
Nice.
But they did send me a fossil back, so there was some encouragement. When did you first get encouraged that you could do this?
You know, I didn't get any encouragement really. I mean, my parents were certainly fine with it as a joke job when I was a kid. You know, it's like, oh, he's so cute, he wants to be an archaeologist. When I was in college, I went to college studying physics. I went to a technical high school. I did math and science, and that's what I was supposed to do. It wasn't really until I was a junior in college that I thought, oh, there are actually people that do this, and why am I not one of them?
Where were you?
I was in Binghamton, New York at the time.
Does it have a big archaeology program?
No, not at all.
So how did you hear of people doing it?
Well, there was a class being offered, you know, Introduction to Archaeology. And I thought, why did I never take that class? You know, it was an elective. And I did. And then after that, I actually transferred schools. I went to a field program in Arizona, and I decided to go to the University of Arizona from there, and I did. I transferred to be an archaeologist.
When did you discover you've heard about the Maya, obviously, but when did that passion get lit?
You know, I got the opportunity to work in Mexico, in a non-Maya area of Mexico, when I was at the University of Arizona. I went down with a professor and participated in a field program. And as part of that program, some of the older members of the team, graduate students, stole a vehicle from the project and drove to the Maya site of Palenque. And I went along for the ride, and having visited the Maya site of Palenque, that's really where a passion for the ancient Maya took hold. It's simply a spectacular place to see.
And maybe for people like me, you can explain who and where the Maya were.
The Maya occupied the southern parts of Mexico, the Yucatan Peninsula, the states of Chiapas or Tabasco, and then the modern countries of Guatemala, Belize, and the western parts of Honduras.
So essentially Central America.
Yeah. Yeah, the northern part of Central America.
How long ago?
They occupied the area from about 2000 BC until today, A lot of times we hear that the ancient Maya, that they vanished, that they disappeared. But there are millions of people of Maya descent alive today.
And were they sort of the ruling group? Were they the strongest? Were they warlike?
In that area, they were all of those things. I mean, there were a series of warring city-states that existed from around the first century AD until around the 10th century. So from around 100 to, let's say, 900. And in that time, there were a lot of different cities ruled by hereditary kings that were at war with each other, oftentimes at war with their siblings in charge of other Maya kingdoms.
So they were all Maya. It wasn't like Maya versus Aztec.
No. I mean, they were essentially, it was Maya versus Maya.
So I have not had the opportunity to travel in Central America, but should I want to go down on a archaeological vacation, I guess, what would I see?
Well, if you came to Guatemala, you would see cities like Tikal with temple pyramids that are, you know, hundreds of feet high, sort of towering above the rainforest canopy, that are the remains of cities that once housed tens of thousands of people in their heyday.
We're talking with archaeologist William Saturno, and the Maya are his, I assume they're still your passion because you're still working on them. When I say the word archaeologist, two things come to mind. One is somebody with a tiny brush and a little kind of chisel in a big hole, methodically not finding a whole lot, but things are divided by strings into little squares and they're just kind of brushing. The other image is Indiana Jones with a bullwhip. And I imagine the reality is somewhere in between those two.
The reality is indeed somewhere between them. I mean, archaeology itself, most people think about archaeology and they think it's the study of the past, right? It's ancient things, but it's not. Archaeology is really the study of people. But it's the study of people through their things, right? Whereas anthropologists might be able to rely on interviews with people and interactions, or psychologists or sociologists and different types of data. Archaeologists look at us through our stuff, through our garbage mostly.
Yeah, I was going to say midden piles.
Behind.
Yeah.
In terms of what the day in the life of an archaeologist is like, it really depends on what you're looking for, what questions you're trying to address. And there are some of us that work very meticulously in very small areas, you know, cordoned off by string, trying to record the elevation and position in three dimensions of each little flake of stone tool that might be found. And there are others of us like me that I excavate a city. In Guatemala, a city that covered 20 square kilometers. So if I attacked it with a dental pick and some string, it would take, you know, millennia for me to get anywhere.
And you knew the city, you know where these cities are that you're going to excavate?
Well, I mean, if you think of what happens to a city once it's abandoned, that it's been reclaimed by forest, essentially, that most of it is small houses that were deteriorated. Just they're now hills,
right,
essentially, of rubble. But large parts of the city were urban, right? So that they are large structures, again, hundreds of feet high, made of masonry that are surrounding large paved plazas. So that when you're in them, you know that you're in the forest because it's filled with trees. But at the same time, you know you're walking through a place that a millennia ago was filled with tens of thousands of people on market day.
Right? So you're officially a faculty member at Boston University, I believe. But your field work is in Central America, as you mentioned. What's the relationship that you have with the governments in the modern day governments in these places? Because we've heard, you know, like the early 20th century British archaeologists, you know, looting Pharaoh's tombs.
Right. I mean, all of the work that we do is under the auspices of the Guatemalan government, so that each year we apply for permits to conduct investigations. All of the materials that we find stay in Guatemala, including my field notes.
Really?
So that all of the original materials, all of our original drawings, maps, so as I say, my own notes stay there. I can take a copy home, but the originals are all part of an archive that gets left for the government of Guatemala.
And that kind of relationship has really evolved over the last 100 or so years, right?
Certainly. I mean, there was a time when archaeologists would participate in what's called partage, right? They would get a cut of the things that they found, oftentimes saying, well, we're funding all of the excavations and we'll leave, you know, 80% of the stuff here, but we'll take 20 and then choose the 20 that's prettiest.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the most useful, but the prettiest 20. Now, that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, certainly there was a time when that was an appropriate way to try and get field work done. But now, I mean, there are all of my work in Guatemala is also collaborative. I mean, I direct a project. I have a Guatemalan co-director to that project. For every North American student that I bring to work, there's a Guatemalan student that I'm also training. So that it's really a collaborative endeavor to uncover the that nation's past, but also part of our world's past.
Now, let's get to the sexy bit, the Mayan calendar. Last year, that was all the buzz. You know, the world was going to end on this certain date because the Mayan calendar told us so.
Yeah, it was very puzzling for me because the Maya calendar never did tell us that. We told us that for whatever reason. We looked at, you know, it's essentially like looking at December 31st and saying, oh, my God. It's over. This, you know, there's never going to be a January 1st. The difference being that the Maya plotted out a very long period of time that was roughly 5,000 years, a little more than 5,000 years.
Wow.
And that period of time, that was the longest period of time they conventionally kept track of, because after all, who was going to need a bigger period of time to keep track of, that was going to come to an end and the new one would start on the following day. People were sort of puzzled. It ends. The world, they've told us the world ends. It was remarkable. The Maya don't even have a myth for the world ending. Like they have myths of creation when the world begins, but there was never a story that the world will end in this way on this day ever. They never did that.
And in fact, it didn't end.
It didn't.
But I read that you found actual proof to show somebody. What is that proof?
Well, I mean, really anything that's found is proof that they didn't think the world was going to end. In the instance, what I found was a series of numerical tables that a Maya scribe, really some of our earliest evidence of Maya astronomy and mathematics, that they were calculating periods of time. And one of those periods of time was considerably longer than the duration that the world was supposed to exist. So it demonstrated that they thought about time in larger periods than, you know, the expiration date we had placed on it.
So when I want you to think back again to that backyard digging that you were doing, is the work that you do now what you thought being an archaeologist or what, you know, your childhood brain had imagined would be?
I never imagined that I would find the things that I found, that my journey into archaeology would take me into the lives and minds of a people that flourished and endured for thousands of years. And like when I was a kid, it was just the thing, right? I mean, archaeologists, as I said, study people through their stuff.
Right.
But as a kid, it was just the thing that I was looking for, really no more than a treasure hunter. But as an archaeologist, it's so much more fulfilling than that, both the collaboration and also just coming to know this group of people and see how much like us they are and were, and what we can learn really from them, from their endeavors and their mistakes.
You're relatively young. In fact, you're pretty young to be the specialist on the Maya. Do you at some point do you say, well, that's what I know about Maya, and I'm going to move south and study Inca or north and study whoever?
I mean, one of the things about archaeology is we're horrible at sort of prioritizing. I mean, essentially, if you're an archaeologist, you're sort of interested in everything. So the fact that I worked in the Maya area was really just because I was exposed to the Maya area. I've done field work in South America. I continue to do field work in northern Peru. I've done field work in Southeast Asia and Cambodia. But the Maya are really, you know, that's – it's not just where I've done work. That's where my family has grown up. That's where I've spent the last 20 years forging relationships with the people that do archaeology there. And so despite interests in other parts of the world, they'll always just be secondary interests because you can't really leave home.
William Saturno is an archaeologist. He's on the faculty at Boston University, and he's going to be speaking tonight and tomorrow at Benaroya Hall as part of the National Geographic Live series. Thanks so much for coming and talking to us today.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks.
This is Weekday on KUOW.
This is KUOW 94.9 News and Information. It's 10:30.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Farmers and Ranchers. The Washington Grown Project celebrates family-owned and operated farms and ranches, which produce apples, wheat, and potatoes for Washington State and the world. Learn more at wagrown.com.
Evgeny Morozov calls himself a digital heretic. He says the beguiling future portrayed by advocates of digital technology is bunk. Hear him explain that to Ross Reynolds today in the noon hour.
Support for KUOW comes from North Seattle Community College, now offering a Bachelor of Applied Science degree in International Business, preparing students for careers in global marketing, finance, trade, and commerce. Enrolling now for fall quarter. More at northseattle.edu/BAS.
54 degrees. Today's high expected to be around 70, mostly sunny. Tonight, look for a low around 48 degrees, mostly cloudy, rain likely. On Tuesday, the high in the mid to upper 50s with showers, and Tuesday night's low around 46, cloudy with showers likely.
This is Weekday on KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. As Americans, we've come to expect medical intervention can give us a new knee, help us survive cancer, a heart attack. Medical intervention can even extend our lives. But is intervention always the good idea? And are we informed enough to know? Katie Sewell talked with retired pulmonary and critical care doctor Jim DeMain about that.
He's emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of a hospital ethics committee. He frequently talks to patients about end-of-life issues. I asked him to describe a time when he saw medical interventions go too far.
Well, one day I got a call from one of the transfer coordinators. It was a group health patient that had been admitted to a community hospital. And she was an 84-year-old woman who'd had multiple strokes, had a feeding tube, and was being cared for in the home by the step-grandson, who was in a very isolated environment. And he had started watching the televangelists on TV and believed that he was talking to God. So that was the background of when she stopped breathing. He called 911. And she was admitted to the community hospital, and it was determined, you know, that she had not really been out of bed for a few years. She hadn't been communicative with anybody else in the family. I mean, she was basically in a semi-vegetative state. and didn't even respond to discomfort much, although she would moan on occasion. At the community hospital, they initially felt that she was too sick to transfer back to our hospital. But one day, the nurses found that he was putting herbal medications down her endotracheal tube. He would actually disconnect her from the ventilator in the ICU and try to put these herbal medications in an endotracheal tube. And so that made them determine that she should be transferred. So anyway, she wound up on my watch. I just happened to be the doctor on call that day in intensive care. And we really tried to work hard with the step-grandson. I had our chaplain see him. We had social services see him. I brought the rest of the family in and explained the situation, that the normal process that we would use to determine what her wishes would have been. We had no record of that, no advance directive. So we didn't really have anything on her record, though we talked to the other family members, and they said, well, she probably wouldn't want something like that, but we're going to defer to the step-grandson because he's been doing all the work over the years. Mm-hmm. So we had this impasse. And this is a really difficult situation where we went on and on probably for 3 or 4 weeks before the patient just finally died on the respirator. And we were all a little afraid of the step-grandson because he was so strange. We didn't know how he would react. And at the end, though, he just walked away. He had actually posted a memorial service for her 6 months hence. He had posted it in the ICU, like, you're all invited. You know, so he had predicted her date of death, but it was wrong. So when you run into these difficult situations, it's usually mental illness, or there's drug and alcohol problems, or simply fighting in the family where one person feels left out in decision-making. I've seen that. You know, you killed my mother. What did you do? You know, why did you give her this drug or whatnot? So I think if I walked into any intensive care unit here in Seattle or in the country, I would find, and you took the nurses aside and said, is there anybody in this intensive care unit that you think has been on life support too long? And I'm sure you would find somebody in each intensive care unit. It takes a while. It's emotionally very difficult to transition from life care support, where you're going full bore and saying, okay, we've reached a limit here. It's time to go for comfort care.
Mm-hmm.
And there are families that are well integrated, that can really understand, but you run into cultural and language and other issues that can be very difficult.
Do you also find that sometimes, say, the children of a parent who's dying, for example, would just prolong the life of their parent because they can't face letting them go?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is where, as a parent, it's very important for you to communicate your wishes to your children. If you can do that and say, hey, if I'm in this situation, please don't put me on life-prolonging care. What that does is it takes the burden and guilt off the children. What they're doing then is carrying out your wishes. And ethically, it's very important for the medical providers, nurses, doctors, social workers, and others to determine that you're really carrying out the patient's wishes, not the children's wishes. And in the state of Washington, it's very difficult if somebody hasn't filled out their advance directive or a durable power of attorney for health care. If you're going to fill out just one form, it should be who's going to speak for you, who's closest to your heart, who can talk to the doctors. And that's a legal form that says this person can make health decisions for you. But if you haven't filled one of those out, well, the top rank is if a guardian has been appointed. And in the super difficult situations, sometimes that's what you need to do in order But it's hard for a guardian to step in and make those decisions. Then it falls to the spouse. If a spouse isn't available, it goes to all of the adult children, and they all have to agree. So if you have five kids and one of them disagrees, then no decision is made, basically, or you would continue on with life support. So it's usually the kid who feels left out and that can be the fly in the ointment that holds decision-making down. And social worker Joy Moritani Dennett and I have worked together to develop a model of shared decision-making that we used in the intensive care unit to try to get all the family up to speed. And sometimes this means conference calls, further conferencing. You know, sometimes the doctor will walk in, make a medical pronouncements, basically saying, I think this and this and this ought to be done. And then the hard work is left to the nurses and social workers. But to follow up with the conference with a lot further discussion and clarification. And usually over time, families will function normally. But sometimes you're really at odds. They're waiting for a miracle, and it becomes a real ethical dilemma. And hospitals now have ethics committees, all hospitals do, so sometimes the very difficult cases will be referred to an ethics committee, which includes providers, consumers. The richer the mix, the better the ethical deliberation will be. Mm-hmm. And in general, the ethics committee makes recommendations. That's not like going up to the oracle and having a pronouncement. But the ethics committees certainly can help. And hospitals now have what they call futility policies. Not every hospital does. Saying if it really comes down to the ethics committee has met and this is futile care, and all the providers feel it's futile care, and if the patient wants to continue, then you make a determination that they have to find another institution or someplace else to go. And rarely, but it does happen, the patient could be taken off life support based on the principle of futility, but that's hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Speaking with Jim DeMaine, who's a retired pulmonary critical care doctor, he writes about end-of-life issues at his blog, endoflifeblog.com. Did this exist? These kind of ethical committees and social workers and nurses with training on how to deal with these issues when you first entered the business, the medical business?
Well, you know, I started as an orderly working in a hospital when I was in college. And then I had an old-style family physician father. So I've always kind of been around medicine since I was a kid. And in the old days, and even when I started my internship and into practice, there were no intensive care units. Ventilators were relatively rare. The first ventilator I ever used was on a tetanus patient in Wisconsin, which is extremely rare in the United States. But we had no intensive care unit. We had no alarms on the ventilator. It was just an old ventilator we had from the anesthesia department. And we had really no CPR. So if somebody died, they just died. You know, you took care of them as best you could, and usually the family physician was involved. And it was definitely more personalized. But then as the technology came along, we discovered we could do a lot more in a lot of different arenas. But then, ironically, we became less personalized. And I think one of the big difficulties, particularly when you're making life and death decisions, is gaining trust. I mean, I walk into the intensive care unit as a total unknown. Mm-hmm. So how do I establish rapport with a family? How do I become believable? And one of the techniques I used was to just try to be totally honest and to tell stories. Say, well, you know, I just had somebody like your father here last week, and this is what happened. And then to get interested, it gets a little depersonalized. And they say, well, what did you do or what happened? You know, so it gives them an idea that, yeah, I've seen this before, and yeah, other people have gone through this. And then you begin to approach some level of trust. But it takes a while, and some mm-hmm. people can trust right away, and some people, they've had bad experiences, and it's difficult.
Yeah. Why do you think it's become less personal as technology advances? Is that just because you try this, and then you try that, and then you try that, and there's more options?
There's more options, and there's also a lot more people involved in the care. It used to be your family doctor or primary care person would come see you in the hospital. Now they might make social rounds. So when you become really ill, you're moved to the hospital and then would have a hospitalist look after you. So that's somebody that you wouldn't know. And then you have a whole bunch of new specialists come in and see you. And you really need somebody in charge of the total care, because specialists will, you know, the dialysis people will come into the intensive care unit. Yeah, sure, we ought to start dialysis. Or sure, we ought to think about a bone marrow transplant. But how about the rest of the patient? So it's got to be somebody that can really communicate with the family, coordinate the specialists, come to a common outlook. You know, what's the prognosis? What's the outlook for this patient? And what treatments might cause harm? What might cause benefit? And then try to weigh that out. And this really falls onto the what we call the consultative internal medicine or hospitalist. They're pretty much hospital-based, and it's a difficult job because they're seeing multiple people with multiple demands and a lot of need for family conferencing. And then when they leave the hospital and maybe come back the next time, they might have a different hospitalist. So it's difficult. One of the good things about coordination has been the advent of electronic medical records. Mm-hmm. So that is a huge improvement in terms of coordination of care. But we're still not the high-touch care that we used to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that this can be learned. It's an art of medicine thing. Like when you sit down to talk to a patient, you should sit down, maybe even lower than where they're sitting. You should use English that they can understand. And a lot of doctors speak in, it's like speaking in a foreign language where you need a translator. And that can be learned as to how to do that. And then how to really personalize your concern about them. And then how to follow through. One of the things I always recommended to family physicians was after a death, to call up the spouse or the grieving individual, whoever that may be, and make some kind of contact and allow them, because they'll have questions. Was it really this that happened, or what do you think we should have done, or I'm still wondering about whatever. So you have all these lingering things that can happen. And then some doctors will attend funerals or, even speak at a memorial service. But it's difficult given the time constraints that we all have and then the intensive medicine. We have an aging population now, so we have more and more of this going on. And as a society, we still have wide variation in the use of hospitals at death. If you are in Manhattan, you have more than a 50% chance of dying in a hospital. If you live in Mason City, Iowa, or Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where they have a wonderful program, it's about 7 or 8% would die in a hospital. And you have huge variation. So you have this huge variation in care that is really, everybody would argue, oh, this is cultural or my patients are different or whatnot. But if you do it right, we should have most of the people who are dying on hospice care. And kind of a gold standard is at least 70% of the people that are on the path to dying should be on hospice care. And nationally, it's much lower than that.
Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He frequently gives talks to patients about planning for the end of life. Do Americans expect there to be too many interventions? Do we expect to go in and be healed?
Well, of course, everybody now wants a new hip or a new knee or to stay active. And actually, we've done some wonderful things to keep the aging population active and engaged and involved. And the interventions tend to vary by supply. If you have a lot of orthopedists in a community like Bend, Oregon, you'll have a very high rate of orthopedic surgeries, amazingly. So I think it kind of varies. There's an interesting book written by Jerome Groopman from Harvard with his wife. It's called How Patients Think. And some patients are very adverse to procedures, to any kind of intervention. They want to read about it on the internet. They want to study the whole thing. They want to see all the downside, and that's fine, you know. But they're going to be risk averse. Others are going to say whatever the doctor says, I'll do. They're kind of the extreme at the other end, and most of us are in the middle. We want to hear what the doctor thinks, but some of us will step forward and do what the doctor thinks because we don't want to disappoint the doctor. So I wouldn't worry about that. You know, it's okay to disappoint the doctor. You need to get really comfortable if you're going to go in for that knee surgery. Get a good informed consent. See a video, I think, of what a good outcome is and what a bad outcome is. And then what the percentages are, you know, okay, I have a 1 in 500 chance of dying from this procedure. What, I'm not sure that's an exact quote, but, you know, do I want to risk that? Am I bad enough that I want to do that? So I think as consumers, we're kind of all over the place. We tend to take recommendations from friends. We tend to do what our friends are doing. Then we hear on the news at night that maybe we don't need as much prostate surgery as we thought we did, and so you need to have those discussions. But if you go see the urologist, you may well be told, gee, you need surgery. You go see the radiation guy, say, oh, no, we can radiate that prostate just fine. You go see the oncologist, say, well, maybe you should or maybe you shouldn't, and if you get problems down the road, we could use some chemotherapy or hormonal therapy. So get educated. But, that does cause some confusion because technology is evolving and I learned in medical school, it said the questions never change in medicine, but every few years the answers do. So I think we need to stay abreast, but you need to have a doctor who's conservative, that will operate if necessary, we'll do a procedure if necessary, but not just mindlessly. You know, they say a surgeon's like a hammer in search of a nail. You know, you don't want them mindlessly out there recommending a procedure just because they can do it.
Well, and a doctor, I would think, feels the expectation on their shoulders that their job is to save lives.
Right.
Does that make some of them go too far?
I think we're kind of taught that in medical school. I was taught even that we don't mention the word cancer to a patient. We always whisper it to a family. You know, I was in the really, really old school. So I think that, repeat again. What?
That there would be an imperative that you need to try to figure out a way to save this person's life. And any less than that is a slight failure on you.
I think that's a real problem. Doctors can look at death as a failure. And we're trying with medical students. There's a really good guy at University of Washington, Randy Curtis, who does a lot of end-of-life research. How do we communicate? They found oncologists, if you video them and are talking to patients that they have cancer, don't even use the word cancer a very large percentage of the time. So we need, as doctors, to learn to face up to the fact that basically the root word of doctor means to teach. So we need to be teachers. We need to participate in shared decision-making with the patient, not that we're the doctor and you're the patient. But let's get a team going here with me and you and our support team of nurses, social workers, hospice, whoever it is, and let's focus on your illness and see what we can come to as the best decision. It's something we need to get over psychologically. You know, I think we're taught, and that's kind of the naive expectation. We go into medicine, we're here to save lives. But I think we're really here to teach and try to make people's lives more functional, more comfortable, right up through the end. But it's a participatory thing where we're in it with the patient, knowing that we're all going to face the end, no matter. I mean, that's kind of pre-written when we're born.
And there is a level of naivete. Like you mentioned CPR earlier.
Yes.
CPR is something that most of us would consider something that's very benign. Like, why would you not want somebody to give you CPR? Why would you not want somebody to give you CPR?
Well, CPR, you know, we're in kind of the innovative place where CPR was really studied and researched and used widely in the community. And, of course, medics do it. And as a consumer, private citizen, you can learn to do basic CPR. And it can save lives. I'm not doubting that. There are situations where I would find it totally inappropriate, and I've seen it done. It would be in the terminal cancer patient, 85-year-old woman, let's say with metastatic breast cancer throughout all her bones. But for some reason or other, advanced directives never created, and she's at home and the spouse calls 911. Well, if you begin CPR, which means putting the hands on the chest and doing compressions, the ribs would break. The lungs could become punctured. It causes a lot of pain. And the nurses have kind of a sarcastic way of referring to that as medical last rites. You know, it's something you would hate to put somebody through unnecessarily at the end of life. It's not the great save everybody thing. If you look at national statistics, there's about 5 to 10% out of hospital survival after CPR in the community. With some recent techniques, it may get a little higher than that. Where it works best is in somebody with no underlying disease that has a sudden cardiac arrest that's witnessed, and you can begin CPR immediately. If CPR is delayed much beyond 5 minutes, you begin to get death of brain cells. And I had a real sad situation where a fellow got up on Sunday morning, went out jogging in Seattle, had a heart attack, hit the ground, and nobody saw it. A Metro bus driver came by, called 911. They resuscitated him, got his heart going, admitted him to Harborview, where everybody goes like that, had no identification on him. His wife was panicked because he didn't return home and they were supposed to go to church. And initially she was angry, but then couldn't find him. Multiple calls finally found that John Doe had been admitted to Harborview. They determined he had no brain function and transferred him over to my care at Group Health. And we had, you know, he had teenagers, lovely wife, and we went through a lot of discussion about what the options would be, but try to keep him going. But neurologists saw him, you know, brain studies showed he had no function above the brainstem. And so they said, well, he would not want to just keep going like that. And they opted for organ donation, which certainly could help a lot of people. And that's a plug also for organ donation, and people can easily do that with their driver's license statement or put that in their advance directives. But he died peacefully. They had their pastor there. The kids were there. The way I would handle something like that would be to have the conversation. Then we turn off all the family steps out of the room briefly. I take the endotracheal tube out. We turn off the monitors. So we're not sitting there looking at some beeping green lines. And we can focus on the patient. And they could hold his hand and say their prayers or have their vigil. And she actually called me up several years later and told me, said, you remember me? I said, oh, yeah. These stories are kind of imprinted on my brain. And she said, the kids are doing well. They graduated from college. And she kind of shyly said, yeah, and, you know, I've started a new relationship. So We both agreed that life does go on.
Jim DeMaine is a retired pulmonary critical care doctor. He's also emeritus clinical professor of medicine at the University of Washington and a member of a hospital ethics committee. He frequently gives talks to patients about planning for the end of life. You can read his blog at endoflifeblog.com. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Katie.
Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell with Jason Pagano and Amina Al-Sadi. I'm Marcy Silman. Jack Walters is at the helm. Join us tomorrow. We're going to be speaking with Seattle Opera General Director Spate Jenkins about the 200th anniversary of Richard Wagner's birthday. It's going to be a Wagner sing-along. And also Walter Mosley joins us to talk about his new Easy Rollins mystery coming up tomorrow on Weekday.
KUOW 94.9 News and Information.
So how does Mel Brooks feel about being on Fresh Air?
Public radio. I mean, this is my career. I'm finished. It's over. I'm picking up cigarette butts.
Mel Brooks on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
You can hear that tonight at 8 o'clock on our second.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.